Omake. Flipwise Turnways. A tale of no canonicity. From The Gods Have Horns. By Saltiside and Shadow Wasserson. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based upon the works of Andrew Hussey. English. Your name is Jade English. And you have always thought the earth was so beautiful. The deep, swallowing blue of the seas, reflecting the sun into a brilliant, glittering shine, the million subtle shades of green and brown that make up its living surface. The soft white of the clouds that dance slowly across its skies. The glitter of its cities at night. Even the hurricanes that swirl across the tropics are strikingly, dizzyingly beautiful. Every time you think to look out at it, it seems to you that it must surely be the most lovely and precious thing in the universe. You wish you could go there, but you can't. So instead you look out the fenestrated viewport at a vast, dusty, gray cratered plain, above which shine endless, endless stars set into the infinite vacuum of space. On some nights, when the earth hangs bright and full in the sky above you like a weightless jewel, you feel like it's so near you could reach out and touch it. You have no illusions about who you are or what you are. The Empress is very clear about this. Pilgrims brought you to the moon sanctuary as a baby for tribute. You fell out of the sky, apparently, which gives you a mythical significance that the pilgrims thought the Empress would like. And just like the food and clothes and jewels and technical marvels and other treasures brought to her from across the universe, the Empress accepted you. And since then, you've wandered as you like, through the sealed halls of the buildings that riddle the surface and interior of Earth's moon. Most of the time, you think the Empress forgets you're here. When she does remember you, it's because you're directly in front of her, watching her cook or use computers or do other things you want to learn how to do. You've learned lots of what you know by watching her, but not everything. You have visitors that teach you, too. There's the pilgrims, of course, who come from all over the universe to see the Empress. They don't stay long. But you listen to their interesting alien languages and look at the colors and shapes of their interesting alien clothes. Some of them look back at you, curious. But you are only rarely able to communicate with them. They're not here for you anyway. Then there's the other gods, who also come to visit. They're more fun and stay longer, and talk with you more often. You're visited by the god with the huge horns who plays games with you and teaches you to fight and defend yourself and shout real loud. He's really cool. Then there's the goddess with the red glasses who teaches you to skate. She's even cooler if that's possible. And then there's the soft-spoken god who sometimes brings you animal-shaped robots and shows you how they're put together. He's really nice too, you think. It was that one time he got into a giant argument with the Empress, and they nearly brought down half the moon sanctuary. You could hear the explosions and collapses from your room. There's also a goddess who smiles a lot and talks really loudly about feelings and teaches you sign language and brings you pictures of cute animals. You wish she'd bring you a real animal, but the Empress forbids it. And there's a goddess who glows like a star, with dark, curly stripes on her arms. She always makes time for them for you when she visits, and asks you if you're feeling okay, and gives you cool things when you ask, like telescopes and computers. She's nice, even though she's serious a lot. Of course, there's the goddess in yellow who brings you books, all sorts of books. You love the books. She's always smiling at you, but sometimes you get a feeling it's not a real smile. There's the god who wears a helmet, and he visits a lot and stays a long time, it feels like. The Empress says he's annoying, but never kicks him out. He doesn't talk to you much, but sometimes he gives you advice, even when you don't want it. And there's the really serious god in red who also brings you books and tries to teach you things about you really don't understand. Problem machines? The books are okay, but they're also super serious and kind of boring, so you mostly skim them. But the goddess in red is a lot of fun. She teaches you cuss words in every language. The day you turn 5 sweeps, she gives you a cigarette. And you know you shouldn't make smoke inside the moon sanctuary, but you feel really cool posing with it unlit. Then there's the weird god who dresses like a skeleton. He usually doesn't talk to you, not even in sign, but you mostly remember him because of the time the Empress told him about how she got you. I wanted to name her Fishbait, she had said of her slices of freshly baked Stargazy pie. But that's not a real human name, I guess. The stupid priest guy looked so glum and shocked, it was hilarious. They told me they'd already named her Jade for her eye color, and I thought that was kind of dumb, so I said, could you give her a last name? And they said they didn't. They seemed to expect me to give her mine, but come on, fuck that. So for the halibut, I chose the language they were speaking, English. I mean, English. The skeleton got it, laughed so hard that the stitches on his mouth ripped. Tears ran down his cheeks from either mirth or pain you couldn't tell. Shut up, Carlos, the Empress had sneered at him. It's not that fucking funny. Pull yourself together. You knew that story already. She still calls you Fishbait all the time. And there's one more god. The one who smells really strong, kind of like perfume. But he only visited once. He acted all sad and kept trying to talk to the Empress while she ignored him. After a while, she kicked him out. You spent all the rest of that day in your room in the dark feeling nothing, and you weren't sure why. So you don't really have a family. Not like in the books and movies and games from Earth, but you know a lot of gods, and you think maybe they're like aunts and uncles? That's a nice thought. The other gods will never take you with them when they leave. The Empress forbids it. You think they'd be willing to break her rules at least sometimes, but either they just don't care that much or the Empress is just that scary. You're not sure which. You get exercise. Roller skating down long, long hallways under the surface of the moon with your robotic animal companions. You read. You tinker with machines. You wave to the pilgrims. You gaze at the earth with your telescope. You're mostly ignored by your patron. After all, what could you possibly offer her? She has everything already. You grow up. You tell yourself you are happy. One day, some sweeps later, you see a meteor. There's no warning. It literally comes out of nowhere. And that shouldn't happen. All celestial bodies move in predictable ways. It's headed towards the Earth. The whole moon complex is equipped with gravity manipulatrices to throw off track any incoming meteorites that might damage its infrastructure. Earth doesn't have those. You whip out your tablet, and with a few clicks, you're in the system. It wouldn't be the first time. The manipulatrices mounted outside instantly hum to life. And the meteor turns only moments before crashing into the planet's atmosphere. It orbits the Earth once, twice, incredibly fast, taking out satellites you really hope are not critical, spiraling outward, and then falls toward the moon. It's okay. It's going to be fine. You peer through your telescope, chart out the trajectory, and the meteor's projected crash site is well out of the way of the buildings and power lines that crisscross the moon's surface. You breathe a sigh of relief and close your tablet. How in the hell did a meteor appear out of nowhere like that? Maybe it's not really a meteor? But surely if aliens or something were going to attack the planet, the gods would have stopped it. After all, Earth is their home. Well, not including the Empress. You suit up and board Rover to head out across the dusty plain. You haven't been out there in sweeps. There's not that much to do, even having the robots to play with, and not many interesting things to see, just craters. You settle into the command saddle and plug in your coordinates. The low gravity outside the sanctuary always makes Rover's strides extra big, so you strap in securely. Then the giant robotic hound takes off in a gallop, leaping small craters and cracks easily. It's very quiet out here with no atmosphere, and though the vibrations travel through your bones and rattle your jaw, you do not hear the Rover's footfalls crunch the regolith, nor the hiss of its mechanical joints. You reach up and flip on your music, and the crooning voice of the artist formerly known as Prince fills your helmet. You hum along to When Doves Cry between the jostling impacts of the rover's bounds. Then you find the meteor. It's not just a meteor. It's a baby girl. Somehow alive, out on the lunar plain. You remember the stories the Empress used to tell. You keep her, and you name her Jane. Crocker. Your name is John Crocker, and until 5 years ago, you were not a very religiously observant kind of person. Oh yes, you grew up with all the usual childhood milestones, as well as a young boy in an orphanage could. A quick perfunctory naming ceremony, group haircutting, a celebratory hostess Twinkie for starting school, that kind of thing. But it didn't really leave you with much lasting love of the gods as a whole. You just didn't feel connected to it. That all changed when you found your son, Jake. He's a gift from the gods. Extremely literally so. Of course, he'd be your pride and joy even if he wasn't, but you've been in such a terrible slump back then, alone, adrift, working a dead-end job. Making ends meet, but no more. However, standing there in the wreckage of your favorite costume shop and cradling the child that had fallen from the sky like a flaming comet, you decided that you would raise the boy as your own, and that you would raise him right with the gods. It was a new life, for you and for him. On the vaulted ceiling of the central temple of glorious ascent, there are bright-lit stars, LEDs arranged into constellations, inset into a night sky made of black velvet. The single round skylight gives an impression of a full moon, and the aperture can even be closed partially to look like the moon is changing shape. Decorating the edges of the design are wooden blocks with gold inlays of the 12 symbols of divinity, with tapestries displaying the sacred cowers dangling down from those. It's a very fancy place of worship, as befits a temple where the eternal gods themselves are known on occasion to visit. But today is a special occasion, and worth it to drive all the way to the central temple. Jake is starting school this year, which makes this his first ascent to the altar. You're so proud of him, you want to do this right. As the opening hymns begin, you smile down at the 5-year-old sitting next to you on the pews. He is staring up at the ceiling.
You recognize the signs?
You ask, pointing up at the symbols. Jake nods.
That's Capricorn,
he says. You smile. Capricorn, you correct him. There's another ca sound.
Capricorn? Like corn in the...
You notice other worshippers staring at you. You should probably stop talking.
Let's be quiet now,
you tell Jake, and he sighs, looking down at the wrapped-up offering in his arms. 2 minutes later, he says,
Is it our turn yet?
Not yet, you whisper. And he scoots forward and drops the offering down on the floor near his feet.
Careful with that,
you admonish quietly. It might crack. And it's a gift, remember? It's not yours. The high cleric is making an announcement. Just this morning, she had received word that one of the eternal gods was coming to visit the temple, and would be accepting petitioners after the service. No other than her clarity, the all-knowing, all-giving Lady of Golden Glass, healer of the blind, seeker of the lost, the illuminated lady, the grand librarian, the sylph of light, herself, would be here, and in very short order. Well, the opportunity to meet a goddess, that's something hardly anyone gets these days, and how special that would be for Jake.
Is it our turn yet?
Asks Jake, seemingly unimpressed with the cleric's announcement. Not yet, you reply. Your son groans and flops over on the bench. Jake, sit up straight, please. This is the temple.
I'm bored. Can we go home?
Later. Now, come on, sit up. You hand Jake an illustrated collection of zodiac stories. Here, read this if you're bored. Your son flips through the book, looking at the pictures and trying to sound out all the words. Clever little tiger boy. But he's being a bit loud.
Latula? Pyrope?
Shh, you say, trying to ignore the stares of your fellow congregants. Read quietly, it's Latula. The rest of the service passes smoothly. When you and Jake rise to ascend the altar, you go to the sign of Sagittarius fixed above the alcove. You instruct Jake to lay the wrapped offering down, and you both offer a whispered prayer of thanks. Well, you do so at least, and Jake tries to imitate you. Thank you, O Page of Void, for the health and happiness of my son. Thank you for allowing me to have such a source of happiness in my life. Please protect him from any who would wish him harm as he grows into this next step of his life. You reach forward and unwrap the offering, revealing the ceremonial horse fashioness. You splurged for a really nice one, polished and carved out of a block of mahogany and shaped to have the legs of a horse as well. It's not the biggest one on the altar today, but you're pleased to see us on the larger end. You put your hand gently, proudly on Jake's shoulder. You wish you could... Oh, hell with it. Let's take a picture, you say, and Jake groans. Heedless to the line of congregants behind you, you fish out your digital camera, cajole Jake until he smiles, and take a picture of him standing next to the altar, full of various fashion. That's one for the scrapbooks. The sylph of light is dressed in a robe of orange silk, embroidered with gold thread in the sigil of her divinity, her spectacles and jewelry, a delicately linked chain woven like a net around her right arm and a necklace bearing the sign of Scorpio are gold. Her eyes and translucent gossamer wings are a deep sea blue, a study in contrast with the rest of her outfit and the bright orange of her proudly hooked horns. She reclines on a chaise lounge, smiling faintly as you walk in. And then you're there. Right in front of her, a private study off the main prayer hall of the temple. You've been waiting for hours, it's worth it. Even if Jake has been fussing the whole time. Well, if it isn't Jean Croker, says the goddess before you even introduce yourself.
And little Jake?
She smiles at you both, showing only the tips of her fangs. I have been waiting a very long time to meet you. You stare at her, feeling foolish, trying to find your words. She's been waiting a long time to meet you? But that doesn't make sense. Haven't you been waiting to see her, not the other way around?
Dad?
Jake almost whispers, tugging on your sleeve.
Dad, is that her?
Yes, you say, finally finding your voice. It's a great honor to be in your presence, glorious sylph. You bow. For a brief moment, the sylph's smile grows a bit wider.
You may rise. You haven't always been so devout, Mr. Croker. I'm curious. Why did you give an offering to the page today?
You swallow. Well, I'm not sure if it was entirely apropos, but my son, you softly rest your hand on Jake's head, I adopted him after he fell from the heavens 5 years ago during the dominion of Sagittarius. I always thought perhaps he was a gift from the page, so I wanted to thank him. Her expression does not change from one of polite interest. You try again. Was it not the page? The goddess turns her gaze to Jake.
Not directly. Though I suppose he had something to do with it, as much as we all did.
She looks back at you.
But that's not the most important story to tell right now. If you credited the page with giving you your son, why did you come to see me?
You look down to Jake. Your son is staring at the goddess with eyes like saucers, uncharacteristically quiet. You suddenly feel quite embarrassed, asking a goddess for a favor straight to her face.
Well, I suppose I...
You wanted a boon of luck for him.
The sylph smiles warmly at Jake.
Well, I have something even better. A prophecy.
Your breath catches. She continues, her eyes not looking away once from your son. The world around you seems to become extremely quiet, and as she grants her prophecy, the goddess's smile never fades.
You, Jake, are one of the chosen few. You will end the world. You will survive its end. You will create yourself, and you will die, and you will be reborn. You are a larval god sleeping in mortal skin. If you're strong and brave and lucky and wise, one day you will be worshipped by trillions, or you will fail to rise to the occasion, and then you will perish with the rest of your people forever.
Sorry?
You manage when she's done, and she finally looks back at you.
My lady sylph, did you say he was going to end the world?
Well, that was a short version.
The sylph laughs lightly like the tinkling of bells.
I can give the long one. I like it better. But I've learned over the millennia that it's sometimes hard for others to remember all the details if I don't summarize.
The sylph leans forward and reaches her hand towards Jake. You have the sudden and inexplicable urge to pull him away, but you don't. She tousles his hair, and he grabs your arm more tightly.
Don't worry too much about it right now, John. You have some years yet before your species is destroyed. Try to make good use of them.
She pulls from nowhere a small blue lollipop, offers it to your son, then glances at you again. She looks pleased with herself.
If you need help with Jake at any point, don't be a stranger. I'll be listening.
Your stomach drops into your spats. When you leave the temple, your legs are shaking. You wish you could say you were in shock, like you felt as though you were walking through a fog, but it's actually the opposite. The world has never seemed more clear, more vivid, more true. And it's all the more terrible for it. Jake follows along behind you, lollipop in his mouth.
She was pretty,
he says.
That story she told was kind of scary, though.
He pauses.
But it wasn't real, right?
You hold him tight. And you never go to temple again. Strider.
Your name is Dave Strider. And once upon a time, you would have introduced yourself as a renowned movie producer and director. You were the producer of the cinematic masterwork known as Sweet Bro and Hella Jeff Go to Nam, which nearly earned an Oscar nomination for Best Picture in 1968. You once would have peppered such an introduction with the dropped names of Hollywood hotshots, titles, and quotes from auteur cinema and art films of other kinds, wink wink, and other cultural touchstones from the era of your youth. Not anymore, you're past that, you're better than that. Well, you weren't appreciated back then anyway. Not by the Academy or anyone else in the showbiz, for that matter. Though you've heard your films are cult classics now. How about that? You've always been ahead of your time. But none of that is in the least bit related to why you are knocking on your daughter's door on a rainy autumn evening in Massachusetts. She opens the door. You smile. Dad, she says flatly, what are you doing here? It's coming down cats and dogs out here, Deidre. You jiggle your umbrella illustratively. Can't I come in? She makes an expression of pain but steps aside. You fold your umbrella and shake it over the snow grate. You glance around at the cozy New England house. Lovely place you've made. Well, it serves. Your daughter takes a long, deep breath. Dad, are you all right? Didn't need me to sit down. I'm quite well, thank you. You sit down at what looks to be a kitchen table. How are you? Let me get you something to drink. You watch closely as she goes to a cabinet, pulls out a jug of brandy, takes a long swig, and puts it back before putting on a kettle for tea. Some people don't change. Are you still seeing that fellow, what's his name, Todd? You call to her. No, she calls back from the kitchen. Not for 3 years. Oh, I see. The kettle whistles. Do you still work at Paramount? Not since Roxy, Dad. Your daughter returns with the tea, milk, and sugar. From the look on her face, she's aged 10 years since she stepped away. No, too bad. Where do you work now? Deidre sits down and speaks coldly. So when was the last time you spoke with Dana or Rick or Drew? You pause a moment. This will be delicate. How are they? You keep in touch?
Well, Drew's in prison.
Oh, dear. You let out a long breath. I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't know.
You didn't know because it's not true.
Her eyes are like ice.
You wouldn't have known if he was, though, would you?
You look away. Ouch. A little blow, darling. You see something pink. Eyes peering curiously around the doorframe. You immediately put on a smile and pull your shades down a little so the girl can make eye contact. That can't be Roxy, can it? Come on out, sweetheart. Let's have a look at you. The young girl steps into view wearing cat print pajamas. It's past her bedtime, says Deidre, looking at your granddaughter pointedly. You ignore her. Look how big you are. How old are you, darling?
8, she says,
then glances up at her mother before turning back to you.
Who are you?
Ouch, that one actually does hurt. You don't let it show. I'm your granddaddy, Dave. The girl looks confused.
Granddaddy?
Deidre's frowning.
Roxy, go back to bed, please. It's very late, and you can talk with Granddaddy Dave in the morning.
Roxy shuffles her feet.
Okay, where's he gonna sleep?
On the couch.
Roxy nods, apparently satisfied by the answer, and leaves. You turn to your daughter. She has your nose.
That'd be something, Deidre comments dryly, seeing as she's adopted.
What? But you're single, Deidre.
Actually, I'm seeing a lovely woman named Shay. We might get married.
With slightly trembling hands, Deidre takes out a cigarette and lights it. She doesn't offer you one. You sigh and smile wryly. I sometimes can't tell if you're fucking with me or not. Your daughter takes a long drag. You're out of practice. She turns and looks at you. Really looks at you. Well, yes, that might be. It's been a long time since I've been landside.
You look ridiculous.
She grimaces and gestures at your hair.
That wig isn't convincing in the slightest. Not the dye job either.
Shrug, grin. It serves. Deidre takes another drag.
Why are you here?
Your mouth is dry despite the tea. Sincerity has always been a struggle for you. I left Atlantis for good this time. A raised brow.
Really, and they let you?
Behind your shades, you close your eyes. They had nothing more to offer me. She snorts.
I guess the weird nihilism greaser sex cult doesn't want to keep around dirty old men either, huh?
Anger flashes through you, strong enough that you forget momentarily to cover your underlying Texas 96 cult, Deidre. Atlantis is a congregation, don't talk that shit about it.
Then why the hell do they make you dress like that?
You glance down at your white tank top, leather jacket, blue jeans, and black winkle pickers. What's wrong with it? She sniffs.
You look like you took one step off the set of Grease and instantly aged 70 years.
You sigh, you take a sip of tea. Can't you get your old man something stronger than this?
Deirdre's lip curls, but she fetches the brandy from his cabinet, attagirl.
For a moment, you both nurse your drinks in silence. Then your daughter speaks.
You have nowhere else to go, do you?
I could try Drew, you reply. She actually smiles at that.
See, Deirdre, your old man's still funny.
I've never understood it, she says after another moment. The Atlantis thing.
And I'm not sure I want to.
Why anyone would just fuck off to some cult in the middle of the ocean to wallow in misery and nostalgia. And apparently not even have freaky cult sex.
You grin. Well, I said it's not a sex cult, capital S, capital C. I didn't say no one ever—
Oh, witch's tits. No, Dad, you can stop there.
You laugh, and even Deirdre chuckles a bit. It feels good to laugh again and smile and be with people who don't make you want to die.
That can't be it, though, right?
She continues to press.
Like, that's not the draw, if I'm understanding you. So why do people do it? Why did you do it?
You take a long drink. As long as you can bear. You'd tell her if you thought she'd understand you, about how the world purifies there in the God's domain. How every false impression, everything you thought you knew about the world falls away, rots, dies. How even as it sinks in, how empty life is, how pointless, how futile, how small it all is. You realize that everyone around you, who you held in such esteem, who you wanted to impress, whose perspectives preoccupied your mind for your entire life, are all so small. That your suffering is also small. That if the good in life is worth nothing, so is the bad. That kind of perspective is worth a lot. Maybe not everything, but a lot. You drink. Deirdre does not stop staring at you. You know, you finally say, hardly even noticing the Texas in your voice now. The whole greaser part of nihilism greases is more suggested and aesthetic than uniform. The Bard of Hope didn't even come to Earth until 65 years ago or so. So that's what he's familiar with. Shit. I've been on Earth longer than him. Deirdre says flatly,
that's not an answer, Dad.
God damn, you put down your cup. You wrap your knuckles on the table absentmindedly, almost subconsciously reproducing the rhythm of some radio jingle you heard as a boy.
I left, you say.
Because I couldn't stand the other folks there anymore. They're all egg suckers. Too big for their britches and dumb as posts. Not one of them could even understand that they had any problems.
Must have been peas in a pot then, says Deirdre.
Don't talk to your old man that way, you shoot back, but there's no bite to it. You sigh. But it comes out more like a groan.
You'll make me beg, Tante.
Your daughter frowns at the old nickname.
Yes, if you're going to ask me for something, ask it.
You grunt, straighten up best you can. You'd really rather lie down, your back hurts. And ask your daughter to her face. Can I stay over, Deirdre? I got nowhere else. Her whole body relaxes. Like under her skin, she had a taut balloon, and you just let the air out. Okay, but not for long. We don't have a guest room. You glance behind your daughter. Pink eyes watch you from the slight crack of the door.
Roxy's a clever scamp, ain't she?
Thank you, Dee. Later, as you get your old bones settled on the couch, Deirdre asks, you really aren't going back? A snowball's chance in the vast croak, you reply. She snorts.
Sleep it off, Dad.
And in the dead of the night, you touch the small, embroidered sigil of hope sewn under your lapel. and dream the gray, silent dreams where all your hopes and lies fall away like rain.
Lalande. You are Mother Lalande, abbess of the convent of the Vault of Heaven. The vestments of your station are solid black, as is proper for one of your seniority and position. And your skin is ornamented with the symbol of your order above your heart, the sign of Virgo, overlain with the sign of Venus. You have worked hard to get here, studied and worked within the convent since you were barely out of girlhood, first as a Mariel maiden, then as an ordained sister of the fabric. You have been the abbess now for 8 years. Since your appointment, no one has ever opposed you for the position. The reason no one has opposed you is because just after you were elected abbess, a miracle occurred in the center of the convent's quadrangle. A meteor fell from the sky, a sign from the goddess. Everyone in the convent were certain. And in the wreckage there lay a baby boy, unharmed, crying, and clinging to the singed remains of some kind of doll. The boy was brought to the infirmary while you prayed and meditated on the matter for days. You came to the conclusion that your goddess, as supreme auxiliatrix of all that has ever lived and ever will be, amen, has gifted your convent with the divine mission to protect and raise this child. The fact that he was a male infant didn't factor into your interpretation of the sign, even though men are not, as ancient tradition makes clear, permitted to walk the cloisters of the convent of the Vault of Heaven. Clearly, this child had been given over to the convent with the blessing of the goddess herself. Biological sex be damned. You decide to name him Dirk. You aren't his mother. You cannot be. You have vows to uphold. But you suppose you are his mother. So he has given your last name legally. Since that day, the child has attached himself to you like a shadow, his feet stepping in your footsteps, his lips mouthing your prayers. His eyes are unusually sensitive to light. So you get him tinted spectacles. He is curious and intelligent. So you get him many books to read. He's an oddly serious child, and every other sentence out of his mouth is a question.
Why does the rain come down? Why are the gods signs in the stars? Why don't animals talk? Are there animals in the stars? Why aren't there any other kids here? Are there other kids in the stars? Why don't we ever leave the convent? How do computers work?
He asks as you attempt to send an email. You sigh. You always attempt to answer the boy's questions as patiently as you can, but on this one you are just as lost as he is. The convent is trying to digitize its records, really move into the modern era, but these newfangled PCs have too many buttons and you can't figure out why people are sending you messages about male enhancement. The sisters of the convent almost all prefer women. Why would anyone think any of you would be interested in that? Thankfully, Sister Wenberg, a junior sister, is there to help. She points out the block button and you click it triumphantly. But then more buttons appear, and Sister Wenberg reminds you to use the left clicker on the mouse and not the right. So many moving parts.
Can I try?
The boy asks. No, Dirk, this machine is very complicated, you reply, pecking out the convent's email address on the keyboard.
Please, Mother.
He bounces on the balls of his feet.
I'll be careful.
It might not hurt to teach him, suggests Sister Wenberg hesitantly. It may prove a useful skill, especially for when he has to live, grow up. You know that many of the sisters wonder what will happen to Dirk when he grows to majority. He cannot stay here, is the unspoken understanding, but he is not a normal child. He is not born of man and woman. He is a being of pure, heavenly creation. He is, frankly, like nothing ever before recorded in the entire history of your order, yet you are deeply certain of his divine nature, like you are certain of almost nothing else. Surely he will not grow up and leave to live an ordinary, lay life. That can't be the reason he was sent to you. And no place is more spiritual, more connected to the goddess and the lesser gods than the convent. No better place for Dirk. You concede that Sister Wenberg may give Dirk lessons in computer usage, so long as he does not interact with any of those profane emails you keep getting from who knows where. The smile on Dirk's face when he hears this is huge and genuine and rare.
I made an assistant,
says Dirk, 10 years old, coming into the observatorium one day. You look up from the star chart you are annotating.
What's that? I made an assistant on the computer,
he repeats louder.
Is to teach other people how to use it.
He holds his head high, proud of himself. That sounds like it could be very useful.
you say finally. But I'm not certain what you mean.
Come and see, then?
I will when I finish this. You put your eye back to the telescope, checking the position of Saturn. 75 years old, and your joints may not be as good as they once were, but your eyes and mind are still as clear as ever. Blessed be the goddess. The assistant is a little animated picture, a floating star wearing a set of sunglasses, that sits in the corner of the computer screen. It writes out tips, responds to questions asked by whoever is using the computers. It responds not only to typed questions, but one spoken aloud to the machine, which Dirk insists is state-of-the-art voice activation. It even seems to remember mistakes made in the past, and offers its advice proactively. Dirk calls it Star Shark.
Seems almost like it's alive, you observe, and Dirk shakes his head. It's not, just a program.
He pauses.
Maybe Star Shark is as smart as, like, a bug.
You arch your eyebrow at that. Creating even insect life is the sphere of gods. Dirk shakes his head harder.
Star Shark's smart, but it's not alive. That's different.
He then asks you if he can have his own email address. You decline the request. Dirk is quite talented at art. One day, when he is 11 years old, a young woman is sleeping peacefully in a bed surrounded by twisted, sharp spires, rising into darkness. It's technically well drawn, but the subject matter leaves you concerned. He's so young and dreaming of girls already.
If I close my eyes, I can see her, Dirk says quietly. Is that normal?
I suppose, you say, for some. You can feel the keenness of his loneliness, hear it in his voice. Perhaps, otherworldly as his origins may be, his destiny may not lie within the walls of the convent after all. Perhaps it isn't fair to keep him here as he grows into manhood. You see him sometimes wandering the cloisters, a vacant expression on his face, like he's sleepwalking with open eyes. He moves his lips like he's talking to someone without sound. Sometimes he balls up his fists and weeps without tears. You wait for him to approach you, to confide in you as he always has. But he does not speak a word about it. When he turns 12, you decide to let him have an email account. Immediately after, you find out from Star Shark that he's already had one for a year, that he's been using it to talk on the internet to people outside the convent for a year. But when you ask Star Shark to give you the records of what he's been saying to them, you find only secret code gobbledygook. You're furious at Dirk's disobedience. You raise your voice at him. He raises his voice back at you. You should have realized this would happen, of course. Children do not stay children forever. Becoming a teenager is inevitable. But still, it happened so suddenly. You decide to discipline him by banning him from access to the computer, but then learn within the week that your ward has become quite an accomplished lockpick. You have no idea where he picked up such a skill. You punish him again, with chores and assignments and duties. It does not work. Over the next year, your relationship with Dirk grows ever more confrontational and adversarial. His infractions and mischievous exploits begin to stack up. He sneaks about to use the computer in the middle of the goddess's sacred night, misses devotionals, makes himself bleed trying to tattoo himself with the sacred inks. He sneaks out of the convent and returns with his pockets stuffed with sacrilegious contraband. You even discover he's been playing video games. Your disciplinary measures, insomuch as they are, seem ineffectual. And one day, as you sit your ward down to once again admonish him, he says out of nowhere,
I know where I came from.
He tells you then about the nature of his dreams. He tells you that he dreams while awake, has visions of a dark city of violet towers, that he can fly, that he has been talking with others like him. He tells you he thinks he came from that strange city, that he feels like he fell to earth but left his heart behind. He tells you he thinks he is meant to save the world, or destroy it, or both. You're not a fool. He is reaching out for help. He sees a path before him, and is as sure of its truth as he is frightened of it. You embrace Dirk, as you haven't since he was very small. You always knew he was destined for some great fate. You were not ready for it to come knocking so soon. And that night, you are visited by a god with glowing eyes and dressed in a long hood of darkest green. He thanks you for your guardianship of Dirk and says he will give you another day to say goodbye to your loved ones before setting off the apocalypse. You ask, trembling, if you can meet your goddess, to whom you have devoted the last
60 years of your life. The air points you to Dirk's room. There, your goddess stands, her skin glowing with divine light. Against her scintillating black godhood, emblazoned with the sigil of space, you hobble to her and kneel, as best you can, with your bad knees and kiss her feet. She puts a gentle hand on your shoulder. "May it peace, Rose," says the maid of space, calling you a name no one has called you in decades. "You have done well." Then, as you look up at her, she reaches into her own mouth and pulls out a sword. Then again, and pulls out a computer disk. As you stare, awestruck and uncomprehending, she hands both to Dirk. "I cannot guarantee your success," she says, "but I wish it for you. More than I can say. Your ward, the 13-year-old boy who calls you mother and wears your last name, accepts the tools of destruction and nods solemnly. And before the coming apocalypse, before you perish, before the gods abandon your planet and leave everything you've ever known to die, before the warp and weft of the world is undone in the terrible understanding that at the heart of all creation is void, you manage to do one last thing, which you should have done long ago."
"Dirk Lalande,"
you say, as the timer runs down, as the sky fills with fire, silhouetting the boy against the light.
"I am proud of you, my son."
For the text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Call Me Saltiside and Shadow_Wasserson. Suburban Jungle by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find links to other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and various ways to support me. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.